ladies and gentlemen, Noonan Speaks once again. The date is Tuesday, June 5th. Is that correct, Larry?
Yes.
Tuesday, June 5th. It's about 8:30 New York time where my guest is. It's 3 hours earlier. I don't know why I'm always obsessed with that, but I just think it's kind of cool that we do these interviews in different time zones. Today we actually have a sponsor. For anybody who sees, I'm wearing a Gurkha cigar hat. Everybody knows part of my gimmick is to smoke a beautiful stogie during our interview. I'm smoking a Gurkha Triad today. It is a 15-year-old Connecticut Maduro wrapper given to me by Pat Bush from Gurkha Cigars. Pat and I saw each other today at the Cigar Emporium in Lyndhurst, New Jersey. And he knew I was doing a big interview tonight, so he said, you should smoke something good. I'm smoking a cigar that's at least $200, probably close to $300, but my guest is worth every penny. So to start out, I'd like to talk about the unfairness in life. I am speaking to you tonight from beautiful downtown Garfield, New Jersey, and my guest is in Las Vegas, Nevada. Talk about the inequality of life. Downtown Garfield, New Jersey, and he's in Las Vegas.
But that's right.
There he is already.
He's having the cream of the crop of cigars, and I'm having the cream of crop of tacos here, straight out of Tijuana, Tacos El Gordo, on
Tacos
the drive
El Gordo.
Back home to Henderson, Nevada. From Lake Mead, beautiful Lake Mead.
You are the man, you are the myth, you are the legend, you are RoboCop, among other great nicknames that you've gotten over your years. He is a UFC Hall of Famer. He is Stefan Bonner. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Noonan Speaks.
Jimmy Noonan, honestly, I haven't heard that in 20 years. That was Carlson's Gracie's nickname for me before he died, was RoboCop. And I haven't heard that in a very long time. When did he die in 06? Yeah, like 13 years. My goodness.
I do my research, bro.
What a great teacher I had. I was raised in this sport by Carlson Gracie, the same guy who raised Brazilian top team. The Nogueiras, the Merlo Bustamante, Vitor Belfort, you name them all. Anyone who came out of Brazil was through the Carlson Gracie system, and I am his last samurai, and I hold a lot of pride in that. I take some honor, so let's have a second here on your podcast, Jimmy Noonan, just to honor the master, Carlson Gracie. Thank you for bringing me up in the sport.
Oh, my pleasure, bro. You know, it's when you were a kid, did you want to be a fireman, an astronaut, or did you be one guy who kicks ass for a living? I mean, what did you want to be when you were a kid?
In fifth grade, we had this conversation. And the teacher went to me, Stefan, what do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be a professional wrestler. And she said, hogwash, pick a real job. And my second job was I want to be a stuntman. And hogwash again, pick another one. But that's what I wanted to be, a professional wrestler and a stuntman. It wasn't until my junior year of high school, I first saw the UFC, that I recognized that existed. And then I wanted to be a UFC fighter, but before that, I wanted to be a pro wrestler. That was my dream.
And you did get to address that at one point, am I correct?
I'm pretty sure I was sent to the principal's office, and I tried to defend a stuntman. I was a kid who was always in trouble, but whatever. It is what it is. I am doing my childhood dream, my first childhood dream. To be a professional wrestler, I am finally, at the age of 40, fulfilling that childhood dream.
26 seasons, granted 2 a year, but 26 seasons of USC, and you come out all these years later as one of the top names, if not the top name, and we're going to talk about your big fight later, the legendary fight, but how does it feel after 26 seasons of The Ultimate Fighter to be so relevant and so and treated like royalty like you are? I mean, you're a Hall of Famer, bro.
It is what it is. I put the sport over. Like, so many people, they weren't onto it. They wouldn't, like, back it and say, yeah, I love the sport. They weren't. They weren't onto it. And, like, I had the kind of fight that made you say, you know what? I don't care what anyone else says. I like this stuff. You know, I'm going to support it. You know what? These guys, they got my vote. And I kind of had that fight that brought that out of people. And so many people were like that. Dude, I've been trying to shove UFC down people's throats since it came out in the 90s. I took the VHS tapes to high school parties, and no one loved it the way I did. And, like, I just happened to have the kind of fight that put the sport over and made people kind of, like, agree. Like, you know what? I like this sport. I you know what? I'm going to watch it some more. I like where it's going. Like, I'm a fan. Just like probably the same way that Attitude Era did in the pro wrestling, WWE. Like, I know a lot of people in that era, including myself, I wasn't completely convinced. I was a fan in the 80s, but when I worked at Roadway in the late 90s and my friends were fans, I didn't want to be a fan. I was kind of ashamed. And then I watched Stone Cold belittle Vince McMahon, and I said, you know what? I don't care what they say. I'm a fan of this stuff. Like, I love pro wrestling. And, like, I think what me and Forrest did for the Ultimate Fighter is the same thing that Stone Cold did in the Attitude Era.
So the Ultimate Fighter was originally an experimental series financed by the former owners of Ultimate Fighting Championship. And because of the success of your fight with Forrest Griffin, the Ultimate Fighter was regarded as instrumental to the survival and expansion of the UFC and mixed martial arts into the mainstream. That's got to make you feel every day like $1 million, man. You made it happen.
Well, honestly, Jimmy, you know this. Pro wrestling is psychology, and the psychology of that fight won people over. The psychology of, like, Stone Cold and the Attitude Era won people over and made them diehard, lifelong fans. And you know what? Like, it's the same, brother. It's the same. Like, you know, I love the UFC ever since it came out. And you know what? Like, my dad's the one who turned me back on to watch this. Watch what Stone Cold's doing. And made me fall in love with pro wrestling all over again. And there's so many similes when you break it down. Like a lot of people say, like, me and Forrest are kind of like the WrestleMania 1 of mixed martial arts. Like, the Ultimate Fighter was the first WrestleMania. Like, the thing that kind of put the sport over. And, you know, I take that as a compliment, Jimmy. I do. And you know what? If someone says that to me, I'm flattered.
So Stefan, you're talking about the psychology of wrestling and what all the great guys know, the Stone Colds and the Rocks and the Harley Races and the Andres and the Hulksters and now Cena today. You're talking about what makes them great. Are you saying that you and Forrest Griffin and perhaps Dana and the Fertittas actually got together before this fight and had an idea of some type of psychological?
From other people's mouths, from other people saying that was a breaking point. That was the thing that won me over. It was after that fight, then me and my family, we got together. We bought the pay-per-view and we bonded over the fights. And I mean, it was like the magical moment that made stuff happen. And honestly, the only reason I compare it to me and Stone Cold, because back when in 1985, or what was it, 85, I don't remember, but at WrestleMania 1, 2, 3, like, the thing that bonded me and my dad over WrestleMania is the same thing that brought people together over mixed martial arts and the UFC. Like, I hear that from people. Like, it was that thing after that fight. Like, after that, me and my family, me and my son, me and, like, my son's kids, we'd all get together and we'd bond and we'd watch the fights. And it was something that we were proud to be a fan of.
Now, you tell a great story. I don't know if you told me this story at Dave Bautista's wedding when we were sitting around the next day at breakfast, but you tell a fabulous story. And the way I remember it is this. One day you were sitting in your agent's office, and correct me after I set the premise. One day you were sitting in your agent's office and a magazine came out, a famous pugilistic magazine, UFC, wrestling, fighting in general. And they were talking about the greatest fights in history. They were talking about Muhammad Ali and George Foreman, Muhammad Ali and George Frazier, 1 and 2. They were talking about Hearns and Hagler. And your agent or somebody very close to you said, oh, by the way, you're number one on the list. And you said, what? You said, number one greatest fight of all time, Forrest Griffin and Stefan Bonner. Would you tell that story to us?
You know what? Like, I was just bewildered to hear that because I'm a fight fan. Like, I grew up, like, cramming the UFC down people's throats. I would bring the VHS tapes to parties and play them and make people watch them. That's how much I was a fan in college. Like, Vitor Belfort versus Scott Ferozza, Tank Abbott. Like, I'd have the party, and you'd have to pay the $5 cover to watch it at my place. So I was, like wholeheartedly cramming it down people's throats. And just, like, for people to say, like, I had that type of more times than I could remember, just when people would say, like, I remember exactly what I was doing at the time of that fight. I remember, like, at my stepfather's place and, like, playing it for him, and then we bonded, or like, just some magical moment that brought families together that, like, just helped to bond people closer. Like, that moment, like, to put the sport over, that was, like, what the first WrestleManias were. Me and my dad, like, he liked baseball, football, and, like, the American sports, but it wasn't till the WrestleManias that I got him to order it and watch it with me that we actually bonded. And when people share that with me, like, it is, it makes me move, man. It just, like, makes me shut up and like, look them in their eyes and see that, wow, like, this person had a moment with their family that I helped bring together. You know, and I'm not trying to get a big head over it. It's, you know, but it's something else. Like, I know from me, from my own experience, like, from, like, bringing my family together to watch the UFC, it's such a close, intimate moment. And, like, if there's, like, a vehicle, like the Ultimate Fighter with me and Forrest, that could help, like, kind of shove that process forward, and I'm a part of that, that it's so flattering. I don't know what to do. Like, I'm beside myself.
But getting back to that story, do you remember that story? Do you remember the story about hearing that you were in the most important fight in history and that you were, they put you at the top of the list? Do you remember telling that story? Do you remember something like that?
I remember you telling me about it when we were at Dave's wedding, and just as normal, I probably tried to downplay it a little bit, but I mean, what do you say when someone says that to you, you know, and trying to keep your humility? What do you say?
Yeah, well, you accept it and you move on, but you appreciate the moment. And I'll never forget that. I couldn't find the publication. I didn't have a lot of time to prepare. We're really, really knocking out podcasts left and right. If you don't mind for one quick second, I'd like to thank Wrestling Inc., thesportster.net, and Diva Dirt for picking up my Crystal Marshall interview. You know, you are only number 7, I think 8 or 9 in my list of guests. So we're a small podcast getting off the ground, but I've had these incredible guests, and all of a sudden we're being put over so terrifically. I sent you the link last night, you know, about the Crystal Marshall interview, and people are going, because people want to hear about you, they're going to put this one, once they hear it, they're going to put it over terrifically too. I mean, you have this storied career. I mean, your first fight is against Tito Ortiz, you know, which was a split decision, but then your second fight is against Anderson Silva. I mean, what was it like getting in a cage against Anderson Silva?
Honestly, I was just stepping up for the company. I heard they were going to cancel the card, and it was short notice, and I was working for them at the time, but you know what? They needed me, and like for some reason, Anderson meditated and said, I would be honored to fight Bonner, and all of a sudden, I got the call to step up and save the UFC Rio card, and I mean, I couldn't say no. I had been campaigning for a big fight, and I kind of gave it up. I didn't think it was happening. I wanted to fight Forrest again and coach the show, and that didn't happen, and I kind of gave it up. I was good with not fighting again. And then Dana called me and said, like, hey, man, we need you to step up and save this card, or else it will cost us a lot of money. And for one reason or another, Anderson Silva, out of all the names we threw his way, said, like, let's do Bonner. I'll do it. And, it's just one of those things that, as a fighter, you can't turn down. That's like, Jimmy, if tomorrow they called you and said, could you main event WrestleMania with The Rock? I mean, what could you say no? No way. No way. You couldn't say no.
And first of all, I think Dave Bautista said this to me once, and then I heard it since. I've been in a cage, never in a fight. I trained a couple of times in a cage in around 2010, and it's rather intimidating. But the idea of a fight in a cage, somebody said that once you get in a cage and fight, there's two things that come to mind. One is one of the scariest experiences of your life. And number two, it's anybody who gets in a cage and attempts a fight in a cage is a legitimate badass. It is so daunting. And then to come out in Rio de Janeiro in front of a Brazilian crowd. I mean, walk us through the cage. Walk us through, you know, your first couple of fights and the magnitude and the fans and actually being locked in a cage with another human being.
Honestly, I think the person that says this the best is Forrest. And, like, I'm quoting Forrest right now, but it is exactly how I feel. Like, you're so scared of the tiger. You're so scared of the beast. You're so scared of getting eaten alive. And you've been fearing it and fearing it and fearing it. But finally, when it's there, when it's like the doors are locked, no one can come inside, and it's just you and that tiger, there's a certain type of peace, of serenity that just comes over you that it's so hard to understand. It's just something that, like, money can never buy. It's finally, the tiger's here, and you're locked in the cage, and, like, nothing else could get to you. You're just... like you're like in another dimension, another world. And I like, that's how I felt. Even with Anderson Silva, that was like, finally, it's all over. That was on short notice. So I was getting hit up for interviews left and right, and my phone ringing. I was so sick of talking about the fight. And finally, when the cage door shut and that pin went through the lock, and I realized that it was just me and him, like, there was just this calm peacefulness that came over me that just, like, money can't buy. That's the reason I took the fight right there.
I think they call that a professional fighter, bro. I mean, nobody could describe it like that. A peace and calm before going to war. Wow. I mean, you're ready. You're ready. You know you're ready. You've done all the preparation.
Yeah.
Now it's just execution, correct?
It's finally. Like, even when they announce the fight, there's all those bodies in the ring, all the guys hold the microphone wire and the Bruce Buffer and the athletic commission and all this. And when they all dwindle out and that pin goes through the door and it's just you and Anderson Silva, you're just so thankful that that moment is there. When they talk about living in the moment, that's living in the moment. That's so special. It's every fight has that at every level. Like if anyone listening to this podcast is an amateur fighter and thinks this is any different, no, it isn't. Like when I fought for the, you know, the Chicago Gold Gloves title, or, you know, the Indiana State Taekwondo title, or for the Jiu-Jitsu National title, or like any other like big match, when it's just you and someone else and all those bodies disperse and it's you and the other person, that's the art form. That's what you're doing it for. That's what you're living for. And that is something of beauty. And that's like, that's something you cherish. That's what you hold on to.
I'm a big UFC fan, always have been. I don't know a lot of the guys today, but the guys that I watch, you know, not only do I remember the Gracies and the legends and the way UFC started out, but then that whole different way that you and Forrest brought it into the mainstream. And since then, I've had some favorite fighters after that. I mean, we all started watching regularly after that. And some of my favorite fighters are guys like, because I was with WWE and I had a personal relationship, I loved watching Brock and I loved the heavyweights. You know, I loved him and Shane Carwin and so many guys. I loved to watch Kung Lee fight. I know you did. And I love to watch Kung Lee, who's going to be my guest sometime in July. But you got to fight one of my favorites, a guy that had a certain magic in the ring, and sometimes you couldn't see his strikes coming, and that's Lyoto Machida. Could you tell me a little about the Lyoto Machida fight and the stoppage and what was going on that night? That was also a fight in Brazil, if I'm not mistaken.
I mean, yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a special moment to me too, because certain times you're in there with a fighter and like before the fight starts, you have no idea. You have no idea kind of what's about to come. And when you're in there, like something strikes a chord with you and resonates and says like, hey, like win or lose, no matter what happens, like you're in there with a great fighter. You're in there with a talent that few people could recognize. And when I fought Lyoto Machida, oh my God, like I threw this perfect untelegraphed straight right. Like he's a southpaw, so you can't really jab, you can't telegraph your straight right, but I threw a straight right, straight left, right, like all in succession. And he timed the counter so perfectly, busted my nose and scooted out of the way, that left me kind of in awe. And like later we clinch up, and when we're clinched up, I actually chuckle to myself. I start laughing, and the referee actually like breaks and stops it to like check the blood on my nose. But the reason I was laughing is because on the way into that fight, that was 2003 in the Amazon jungle of Brazil. I went down to Rio. I trained like a week at Carlson School, and then I went to Manaus, a 7-hour flight, thinking I was going to a hotel, but little did I know, I went on a boat and went on to a boating dock, and all of a sudden I'm like a couple hours deep in the Amazon River, and I come up on this guy. Like it just, so the Japanese flag, like the sun setting in the background, and on one side this guy's got a pad holder, on the other side he's got a pad holder, and he's cranking out these punch, 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 kick combinations. Turn, punch, 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 kick. And I'm like, my God, who is this guy? What's he fighting, two people? Little did I know at that time that was Machida. And going in that fight, like going on that boat ride, I felt like I'm a huge Bruce Lee fan. I felt like I was in the movie Enter the Dragon. Like, holy shit. Like, this is it. I'm going to this remote island in the middle of the Amazon River to do this like a total no holds barred type of fight. And then during the fight, when he countered me that beautifully, moved to the side, we clinched up, and I like started chuckling and blood ran down his back. Like, it reminded me that, yes, you are in the movie Enter the Dragon, and you're fighting Bruce Lee, because he totally reminded me of Bruce Lee, the way he held his hands open and loose, and he fainted, and he kind of, while he was fainting, he was making noises. He was like, what-a, what-a, you know, like, totally. And at the time, it was so surreal that it made me chuckle and laugh, and it made me trickle blood down his back. And if you watch that fight and see that, like, that's exactly what happened. Like, I was kind of, at the time, even though I was in there fighting him, I was impressed with his talent. I was a little bit in awe of him. And, like, to this day, watching him, like, look at his last fight. He just beat the 12-0 Eric Anders, ex-linebacker for Alabama, who's been killing everyone, and he beat him in a close five-rounder. Like, that guy, like, he is a hell of a martial artist, and my hat's off to him. I had, like, he had my respect ever since that fight, even though, like, the fight was stopped on a cut. Like, regardless, man, like, I knew I was in there with a talented martial artist, and the same thing happened when I was in there with John Jones back, what, like 6 years later. I was in there with John Jones, and I felt, wow, like, this is the next evolution of the mixed martial artists. Like, this guy, wow, he is so talented. He's going to be hard to beat. And everyone says, didn't you feel the same way with Anderson Silva? And honestly, like, no, here's how I felt with Anderson Silva. Like, my God, this ain't that bad. His counter right hand is nothing. I could eat these punches all night. Wow. Like, I could probably win this fight. And then it was over.
I like that. And then it was over. In respect to you, I have a watercolor, an original watercolor of Bruce Lee, a Longyan. And it's in my background, along with a poster of a movie I did called The Grifters and Marilyn Monroe. And over in the corner, we have my poster from Super Troopers. But for you today, in honor of you, I put Bruce Lee. I knew you were a Bruce Lee fan. And I put him, he's the major picture along with me in the background on the video. We're not going to see the video because this has turned out to be an audio. But I did do that for you. My Lawrence Taylor football. And my Bruce Lee watercolor, my original watercolor by Longyan. That's for you, bro. Oh, yeah.
And hey, after that fight with me and Machida, it was only after that fight he went on to call himself the Dragon and kind of name himself after Bruce Lee. But I recognized it like that dude. And in terms of mixed martial arts, was the closest thing to Bruce Lee the world's ever seen.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. 100% agree. Kung was at Dave Bautista's wedding too. Are you friends with Kung Lee by any chance?
I mean, yeah, we totally cross paths over the years, and every time I run into him, we hit it off and end up talking for a long time. So I love the guy. I have so much respect for him.
Well, you're a respectful guy. That's just who you are. I mean, like I said, I met you at Dave's wedding. I'll tell you a story about Dave's wedding. I was honored to be, I was honored to be there, and they put me at a table, and I didn't know who everybody was. I didn't recognize Kung right away, and they had the Filipino. What was his name? He had five belts at the same time. The Filipino.
Nonito Dodare.
And what was his nickname?
Nonito Dodare. The boxer, right? Nonito Donaire.
Yeah, the boxer. He had five belts at that time, and I didn't even know who he was.
The Filipino Flash.
The Filipino Flash. I had no idea. I was so embarrassed. And then I see you, and you're playing. I remember you at the wedding. You were playing with all the kids. All the kids for some reason. I mean, you got that way about you. You're always carrying a big smile, and you're always playing with the kids. You obviously did kids. And some kid, like leg sweeps you, and you sell it. Something like that happened, and you sell it. And I said, hey, you got a little kid's leg sweeping you, huh? And then you grab me, and you just grab my arm, and you put me in an abdominal stretch just for a split second, and I thought I was going to pass out. I swear to God, your strength and your size, I mean, I outweigh you probably by 50 pounds, and you just put me in an abdominal stretch, and you just smiled at me like, Dude, I still got it. You know what I mean? It was just such a funny moment, and I felt the wrath of Stefan Bonner.
Well, Jimmy, I'm like a big kid, you know? So I love to play around like that. But people really, they don't a lot of times give me the credit. Like, I'm 6'4", 250 pounds lean, and I cut a shitload of weight to make 205. So so many times people come up and like, oh, my God, you're so much bigger than I thought you were on TV. And, like, I'm a big guy, but I'm a playful teddy bear. So, I love playing around. I could roll with any. I could spar with anyone. I don't hurt people. I flow with the punches really well. But believe it or not, I'm larger than you would imagine. I 2-time Chicago Gold Glove Super Heavyweight Champion. Because you don't get paid for cutting weight there, you know? Like, I cut weight to 205 because I get paid for it. Otherwise, like, I would never even consider it, you know? No money involved, no way. So, yeah, I'm bigger than people think. But that's also with pro wrestling, like a lot of people are finding out now. Like, they come and work with me and they're like, oh my God, you're way bigger than I thought you were. You could actually like lift me up and you're a big wrestler, and you know, but yeah, I'm bigger than you'd think. I'm a big playful teddy bear. I'm not going to hurt you, but at the same time, like, I'm capable of it.
2005, 2006. I'm sure there's other years in there, but you had a schedule that was like unparalleled. I mean, you had Griffin, and then you had a guy named Sam Hoger, and then James Irvin, and then Keith Jardine, and then you had Rashad Evans, and then you had Forrest again. I mean, you were fighting how many times a year?
Oh, yes. Yeah, every couple months. And yeah, I never get to talk about that. I don't care to, whatever. It is what it is. Like, I had an opportunity to fight, and I did, but, like, at the same time, I was in desperate need of elbow surgery, and I had it scheduled. And then they said, oh, my God, UFC 62, Chuck Liddell versus Babalu. Chuck already killed him the first time. We're not going to sell pay-per-views. You need to fight Forrest again. No, my elbow surgery is scheduled. I can't, like, fuck anything up. I need to get it. And they said, you know, like, hey, Lorenzo would really appreciate if you stepped up. So I did. I stepped up, and you know, and I was, honestly, I was content losing a competitive decision. Not to mention, 10 days out from the fight, my left eye, 14 stitches. Dana flew me out to Vegas. The fight was called off. And it was canceled, and then I went back to Chicago. My dad took me to the Cubs game on Sunday morning. After we got out of the game, Dana called me and said, we really need you to step up to sell the pay-per-views. And I said I'd do it, and I did. And, you know, whatever. Competitive decision, and it is what it is, and it wasn't the best thing for my career, but at the time I thought I was being a company man, and I did what I thought was best.
Were you healthy for John Jones?
I mean, I was healthy, but I was weak. All right. Before John Jones, I won a couple fights. I was supposed to fight Matt Hamill, and I completely blew my knee out. I thought, I thought it was okay. And, I thought, okay, I'm going to the doctor just because my coach said he heard a really loud pop, but I'm sure everything's fine. So I did, and then I got the call from my doctor, Dr. Sanders, the orthopedic surgeon for the UFC, and I'm expecting that I pick up the phone and say, okay, everything's all right. You just sprained it. And he goes, Stefan, your knee is completely blown out. Your posterior lateral corner is blown, like two ligaments are gone, two tendons are gone, the meniscus is gone, the joint capsule is gone. You need the Super Bowl of surgeries, as he described it. Something beyond my capabilities. I'm going to send you to the specialist in LA who's like reconstructed the best of the best athletes' knees because it's out of my scope of reparations. So I did that. And my first fight back, I was looking for like an easy fight. My manager gave me Tim Bosch. Not to say he's easy. He's a tough guy. He's solid. Or John Jones, who is the unknown. And I looked at him and said, oh, my God, like this guy's a wrestler, these long arms and legs. I'm going to fucking tap this little bitch out. No problem. And then, like I alluded to earlier, when I got in there with him and he threw me around like a rag doll, and I was just fighting back and I like something hit me. I was in awe of his capabilities. And I said, this guy is a hell of a talent. And I think he's going to be on, he's going to go on to be something great. I was favored in that fight. I lost the decision. I won the third round, but still afterwards I was pissed. But deep down I said, wow, like, okay, everyone's giving me a lot of smack now. Because it's MMA. You lose a decision, you're favored. Everyone's, oh, you should hang it up, and you're done, and this and that. And I kept saying in the back of my head, like, hey, this guy, trust me, he's something special. Like, I've had a lot of fights before. Like, I know when I'm in there with someone like Lyoto Machida, and this guy definitely is at that level, if not even further. And I thought that deep down in my heart, but no one would listen to me. No one cared for it. And just as time went on, then I started getting the respect. And then eventually it was before he fought Gustafsson, where everyone just assumed that Rashad was his toughest fight because he went the distance with him. And he goes, no, Stephen Bonner was my toughest fight. I was like dead dog tired in that third round. He was hitting me hard. I was just praying one of those punches wouldn't send me home for the night. And he gave me my respect. And you know what? Hats off to him. At the time, when you were beating my ass, John Jones, like, I recognized greatness, just like I did with Machida. And, you know, I knew I was facing a hell of a fighter.
Do you remember talking to John Jones after that fight?
Yeah. He came into my locker room. I was getting my head stitched up. Remember landing a spinning elbow that, like, my feet went up in the air, and the first thing that hit the ground was my head, and my collarbone went up to my ear pretty much. I had no idea. Right after you get out of a fight, they ask you, oh, how do you feel? Are you okay? And I'm all pissed off. I lost the decision. I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. Leave me alone. And immediately we had the press conference, and then I had to get to an after party. And then finally, when I got back to my hotel room, I went to bed in the middle of the night. I went to turn over, and like I was in the worst pain I ever experienced. I went to the mirror, and I saw that my collarbone was pretty much up in my ear. It was completely separated, and I had to go to the ER and get it nailed back down in my sternum. And, yeah, I went the whole night, like, what, 8 hours after the fight, like, with not even having any idea that, like, I was in that bad of shape. And I even told the doctors I was fine, leave me alone. And, yeah, I have no idea exactly when it happened, but I watched the fight, and I try to recount what may have happened. I think it was when that spinning elbow planted me head first. I think that's what made my collarbone slip out.
Are you a big fan of the documentary from the 90s, The Crushing Machine?
Oh, yeah, Mark Kerr. Yeah, so you I remember when that came out. I was training people in Chicago, and it was one of my clients that turned me on to that. Like, oh, my God, have you seen this documentary? You're doing the mixed martial arts stuff. And this documentary is just right about that. And, yeah, I'll never forget, like, watching that and seeing Mark Kerr and Mark Coleman. And I remember, too, I was a huge Pride fan. Always will be. And like seeing that and wishing that they face each other in the finals, and they didn't, they were friends. That would have like the talk about the perfect wrestling storyline. But when Mark Coleman like ended up smashing those north south knees on Igor Vochanson, winning the title, like I was still really happy to him for him. But like, yeah, I always wanted to see that fight between Mark Kerr and Mark Coleman.
Well, along with the way I see it, along with you and Forrest Griffin, the Crushing Machine is one of the things that put fighting a martial arts cage fighting on the mat. Would you agree to that? I mean, that was so visually stunning, and to see these guys that nobody knew about, it was, I'll never forget it. I remember that one like I remember pumping iron, you know?
That's so funny. That, like, compares my fan days to, like, my doing it kind of days. And it's just a little different. Even when they had Fight of the Year for 2005, like, I actually voted for Little Noguera versus Shogun. Like, I thought that was the best fight of the year. And me and Forrest ended up getting Fight of the Year. But as a fan, like, my hat, like, you know, you don't vote for yourself. Your hat's always off to that. And, yeah, before my fight, when I was just coming up and that documentary came out, and even, like the clients I was training in the gym were alluding to it and telling me about it and had watched it and were fans of it. My God, it was so huge. To me, that was so much huger than, like, my fight. Like, my fight, even, like, a couple weeks after my fight, I went to a bar in Chicago, and we had a viewing party for it. They were replaying it on Spike TV. And even at that time, like, It took a long while to really put it over. Like, a ton of people saw it. Yeah, the numbers peaked at, like, 12 million from, like, under 2 million. But still, like, after that fight happened, it got crammed down people's throats. They kept playing it and playing it and playing it. And really, like, a couple weeks after that, when I had my viewing party, the bouncers at the bar had, like, no idea. They still made me pay the cover charge to get in.
Jesus Christ. That's hysterical, bro.
Yeah, honestly, guys.
That's hysterical. Now, you know where I'm going with this line of questioning, because it brings us to 6 months after John Jones, 6.5 months, almost 7 months after John Jones, you go into the cage with who?
The Hammer.
Mark Coleman.
Oh, yeah.
UFC 100, got to be a big pay-per-view. Come on, it's UFC 100. It's July 11, 2009, and it's in Las Vegas, Nevada. And you're going against a guy who is probably maybe slightly past his prime. I don't know. That's not for me to say. But he's Mark friggin' Coleman, and he's a scary dude.
Here's that fight. Okay, round one, like, standing up, oh my God, I own this guy, no problem. Okay, I'm lighting him up like a Christmas tree. He shoots a single leg on me. What do? I take him to a crucifix, and then I just beat the living shit out of him. I thought I was going to stop him. I'm crushing with elbows. But for a white guy, that guy's got pig skin. Like, he wouldn't cut. I was just smashing him with elbows, and he wouldn't cut, but, like, I owned him, right? Okay, like, I close to stopping and definitely won that round. Second round, like, starting off, I felt the same way, and everything's going good, and I feel like I'm owning them stand up, and I had a dream that I took him out with a spinning back kick. So I, like, step forward through that spinning back kick, and I get missed. You watch, it misses by like an inch, and my hips are deep on him. And right when we go to the ground, I shoot that inside shoulder lock, the same shoulder lock that Frank Mir took Pete Williams out, because, like, I'm Sergio Pena guy, the same jiu-jitsu teacher, right? I know that move. I do it good. I tap people out with it, and I'm stretching it, and with his other arm, he cracks me over my thin white Irish skin with an elbow, and I start bleeding, and the round ends. Anyways, in the third round, like, my confidence was kind of like higher than it should have been. And, like, he fucking fought his ass off, and he secured a takedown a couple minutes in the round. And, like, if I watched that at the time, it didn't feel like much. It felt like on bottom, I'm doing everything right. I'm shooting up submissions and sweeps, and he's basing out and defending, and everything's going good. And, you know, like, time, as a fighter,
you know, sometimes you don't realize, like, sometimes your fight IQ isn't as great as you think it is. And for that fight, it definitely wasn't. Like, I felt like I was doing everything right, and then I remembered scrambling and trying to reverse them, and I finally reverse them, and I hear the 10 seconds clap to the end of the round, and all of a sudden, I'm like, oh my God, no way, is this fight almost over? And then it ends, and I'm back on top, and I knew I had the first round. I knew the second was close, but, like, I'm whiffed with that spinning back kick, and he cut me, and then he got that takedown in the third, and then it hit me. You watch that fight. Like, after we get up, it finally hit me, like, oh, my God, it's over, and I lost a fucking decision. Just, like, most of my losses have gone. You know, you get lost in there sometimes, and that's what happened. And I was just, I was crushed, man. I think I got mad. I, like, threw my mouthpiece, but, yeah, it was devastating, especially because I should have beat John Jones, like, oh, and I lost. Bonner's done. He should be cut. And then, oh, I should definitely beat Coleman. And then all of a sudden, like, I got to go my way. I'm going to stop him. Oh, my God, first round's mine. And then next thing you know, oh, my God, is the fight really over? Oh, my God, am I going to lose a decision? Like, that shit sometimes doesn't hit you till it's too late. And when it does, oh, man. There's nothing. It's one thing to just get smoked, to get outclassed, to go out there and a guy's better than you and you get destroyed. But it's another thing that it's neck and neck. And then one little thing here and there, like, makes him the victor, like the Forrest fight or the Rashad or John Jones or Coleman or, like, so many of mine that it just, it's a hard pill to swallow. It really is.
So when the cage closes and you're in the ring with Coleman, I don't remember what Coleman looks like at this time, but most of Coleman's life, Coleman was muscle bound, and he even had, like, muscles in his forehead. Do you remember the Coleman that had just all these incredible muscles everywhere? It's hard to believe that he was a light heavyweight because he was just so muscular. So,
well, everyone like gets on Kurt Angle's balls. Do you know, like, Mark Coleman tech-falled Kurt Angle in the world championships. Like, winning a world championship is every bit as hard as winning an Olympic gold medal, you know? It's just a matter of the draw. And in the world championships, Mark Coleman fucking spanked Kurt Angle. And he doesn't get the credit for that. And that's the one thing. The first round, watch, I have him in that fucking crucifix. He goes after a single leg. And I am hammering with elbows. And that's my move. In the gym, anyone who shoots a single leg, boom, I crucifix them. And I could take my hip. I figure four my legs, triangle position. I shoot my hips in. Your hips are stronger than someone's arms, right? You should be able to break that grip. So I press my hips in as hard as I can. I break that grip. And then they're mine. Then I submit them. Mark Coleman, his hands were cemented. Like, I pelvised in as hard as I could, and I could not break the grip. That's how strong that guy was at 205 pounds. Like, people don't realize, like, at 220 pounds in the Olympics and the World Championships, tech falling, Kurt Angle, like, yes, he was strong, but at 205, my God, that dude was strong. Like, that's something that should never happen. Like, I should be able to take my hips, crucifix someone, and break their grip. But with Mark Coleman, I could not do that. That's how freaking strong that guy was. And, like, I tell the people, and it just goes right off their shoulder. Oh, yeah, he was old, and yeah, you're a bum. You should have won that one. But that Mark Coleman has strength of an orangutan. That guy is a freak, man. He is incredibly strong. I've never not been able to break someone's grip when I have them in a full-on crucifix off a single leg.
So, fine. So thank you for that, because Coleman is, Coleman, because of the Mark Kerr movie and because of his career, I mean, he's a giant. Everybody knows who Mark Coleman is. Finally, you get Fight of the Night versus Krzysztof Soszynski on July 3rd, 2010. Why were you the fight of the night that night? What happened, and how big was that for you?
You know what? Like, that was just Karma playing itself out, man. We fought at UFC 110 in Australia, and we had a great fight going. And in the third round, it was stopped on a cut caused from a headbutt, and the referee blew the call. He didn't recognize it, and he awarded the win to Kristoff. That was devastating. I was crushed. That hurt so bad. You have no idea. Like, train so hard for something. It's one thing if you straight up lose, but to have someone take it from you like that just makes it hurt so much more. But that gave me the motivation to just train as hard as I did for that comeback fight. And yeah, when I took him out in the second round, when I won that fight and got the fight of the night, it was something else. Or the funny thing about that night was, like, we had a hell of a fight. Like, the fans were on their feet. Like we delivered. Definitely fight of the night worthy type of fight, all right? So after the fight, I have around my head and face, I have 7 cuts that require stitches. So I'm probably on, like, the 4th or 5th set of stitches, and we're in the back, and the doctor's trying to do them. I'm watching Lieben's fight. And Lieben's fight is so good. Akiyama's beating him up, and then he's like, rallying back. And, like, I wanted to see how that fight ended so bad, but at the same time, the surgeon was trying to stitch me up. And he, oh, okay, we only have a couple more sets of stitches to go. Like, but I couldn't help myself. I need to see how that fight, like, I don't care what happens. And it was just like this dichotomy between me and the surgeon arguing and not sitting still, and I'm wanting to see how that fight ended. Of course, Lieben ended up triangling him with like 30 seconds left. It was awesome. And got all my stitches in finally. And then Brock made kind of the comeback of a lifetime, you know? Like, he was completely out of it. Like, I was on the side of the referee to be like, okay, stop this fight. He's had enough. Like, my God, like, you know, don't let this guy suffer anymore. And luckily, I think it was Mario Yamasaki, he did not stop the fight. He saw something in Brock that said this guy is still fighting back, and thank God he did, because that was one of the greatest comebacks I've ever seen. And just, you know, for him to come back from that, to choke Shane Carwin out, to get the submission of the night bonus, and then boom, I get awarded fight of the night bonus, which is, that made it like one of the best nights of my life, honest to God.
You know, you're a professional wrestling fan. You bring up Brock. You know, there are people who crap on Brock Lesnar as an MMA guy. Now let's go over what Brock did. Brock got caught, which guys do, especially guys who are a little green. He's a monster, but he gets caught by Frank Mir. Okay, he just gets caught in the ankle. Boom, it's over. It happens. But, you know, we also don't know what happened in the rematch. But when Shane, and I'm kind of asking if you agree with me. Shane Carwin was 13-0. Basically, what I saw in the business at the time was nobody wanted any part of Shane Carwin. He was devastating. He was built. He could fight. He could wrestle. He could do almost everything. And Brock took that fight on. He weathered the storm like a true professional, made his name in the business that night, and somehow beat Shane Carwin. In one of the most hellacious, you know, attacks I've ever seen. I mean, Brock was almost out, but he does what the greats do. He survived and he came back and got him. Shane got, you know, they were both two big guys. They both got a little blown up. I think Brock got a little less blown up, but people crap on Brock for his career because he was like 6-2 or 7-2 and something like that. How could that be? In what world is Brock not a legend in MMA?
The world of the armchair quarterback. Honestly, every sport has them, and every sport likes to crap on their talent. And honestly, I didn't even know this. Like, to me, like, he's a freak athlete. He belongs there. Okay, he got caught by Frank. Boom. He goes and proves himself. He wins the title. Like, do we really need to keep that argument going? Do people really doubt what a talent this guy is? Honestly, to win the NCAA Division I title, you are a freak. To like, get a medal in the Olympics at wrestling, you are a freak. You are in a different class. And, like, honestly, like, the Olympic level, the NCAA the national winner level, like, you're in the same class of athlete. If you don't give that person the respect right there, then you're an idiot. Honestly, you're an idiot. You're an armchair quarterback. You're an idiot. Really, you are.
And am I correct in assuming, I mean, I wasn't there, but am I correct in assuming that the word was that nobody wanted any part of Shane Carwin?
I mean, look at before that, his record, like, no one made it out of the first round. Yeah, that's another thing. When people want to discount Brock, the fact that he stepped up and said, yes, I will fight this guy who's just been destroying everybody, like, yeah, that says it all right there. Like, you know, like, most people don't want to step up and fight the John Joneses, to fight the Shane Carwins, to fight the guys who've just been annihilating everyone. The fact that Brock step up, you know, he was scared. He was scared shitless, just like we all are. He was, but he faced his fear. He bit down on his mouthpiece, and he went out there, and he faced the smashing machine. And he ended up getting the win that night. But just that in and of itself, man, just speaks volumes of a guy. Because, honestly, look at, like, in the boxing world. Like, look at, I mean, Floyd, he's awesome. I love his talent. But look at, like, he has fought all the best guys, like, at the right times. He waits. He knows when there's not momentum, when, oh my God, this guy just might have had it beaten him out of him. He just got a gift, a majority decision. He should have lost this and that. But no, Brock stepped up and fought Shane when he was killing everyone in the first round. And that should speak volumes.
And then Brock gets diverticulitis, has 13 inches of his lower colon removed, and comes back too soon against, was it Dos Santos?
No, against Alistair Overeem. Twice.
Right.
He's on his deathbed. He almost died, right? Had his colon removed. And then, boom, thought he was going to be healthy again. No. Oh, you're going to die again, Brock. Let me remove another 12 inches of your colon. Okay. And then you recover from that. In your first fight back, we're giving you Alistair Overeem, who's been fighting in Japan for the last 5 years, completely pharmaceutically enhanced. Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. It's just my opinion. Okay. Completely fresh off this stuff. Watch that weigh-in. Look at Brock's weigh-in look at Alistair's weigh-in photo for the fight with Brock Lesnar and compare it to the weigh-in photo of him a couple years later. All right? That was Alistair cutting to 265 pounds, kicking Brock as hard as he could in the body and with a lot of force. And that's how he won that fight.
Are you a fan of the movie Vision Quest?
Are you kidding me? Man, 90s child, I grew up on that. And you know what? Like, I asked Randy and Dan Henderson this, and I'm going to just say it like as a matter of fact, but Team Quest out of Oregon was inspired to be named after that movie.
Okay. So with that said, you are a light heavyweight your whole life, correct? 205 pounds?
Yeah, except Chicago Golden Gloves, I fought super heavyweight because...
Got it. But in MMA, yes. you're a light heavyweight your whole career.
Yes.
Okay, so you want to be Matthew Modine, and you want to cut weight to fight Shoot, right? Okay, you want to cut weight. You want to cut mad weight because you want shoot. Who's your shoot? Who is the guy that you would have lost weight for just to have the experience in the ring with?
Honestly, I have that. After Anderson, I thought, like, I got called out, like, last minute to fill in. That didn't go my way, and I didn't want to go down like that. And everyone after that would do the interview with me and say, what fighter could you have faced? Like, who would you have wanted to face that you never had a chance to? My idea was me and Forrest would do it a third time and, like, really, like, caution the wind, make it super entertaining, coach Ultimate Fighter, make for mad TV. But, of course, that wasn't going to happen in the UFC. And other than that, all I could think of was, like, my God, the only other guy, like, that I feel that way about would be Tito. Because, first and foremost, like, he's a jerk. Like, I know a lot of people have been screwed over by him. And you know what? Like, even if the majority of the MMA world doesn't kind of see eye to eye, I know the guy's a jerk. So he's going around calling himself the, instead of the Huntington Beach bad boy, the people's champ. Like, he, like, totally turned baby face, but deep down he's a heel. So you know what? I'm gonna turn heel. And if people are dumb enough to fall for him being a baby face, then he could have you as fans. And that was the fight. That was the fight I wanted. That was like the big kind of fight I could go on a big campaign against, that, like, this guy's an asshole and turn heel and like have fun with the media. And that was half of it. Honestly, all my fights, like half of the fun was what I was going to say in the promo videos, or what I was going to say to Joe Rogan after the fight. And that fight just gave me the opportunity to do all those things I never had a chance to. Because most of the guys I fought, I liked. They're similar to me. I like them. I have respect for them. But he was the one guy that, like, oh, my God, this guy screwed who over? Oh, Jason Brills. I'm calling the Titan fighting fights. And he fought a Ryan Bader in the UFC, War Team Punishment gear, for a measly $500. No way. Tito screwed you over? Oh, my God. Wayne Harriman, the manager that got me the Anderson fight. Oh, Tito screwed you over? Justin McCauley, the guy when I met him at the Jungle Fight in 2003 when I fought Machida, was like Tito's main training partner. And after that, I'd see him in Tito's corner, all those fights. And then he comes to me, oh, my God, Tito, like, screwed me and never paid me. And it was just like the endless story of people who were screwed over by Tito. So that was like my chance to kind of make it, you know, like, it's just like, let the world know what a jerk he is. And if, like, you weren't, you know, if you didn't, like, see what I was trying to say and you just love Tito anyway, then he could have you. Like, that's fine. But yeah, there was never any fighter in my career that I had complete disdain for until I fought Tito Ortiz.
But he had heat with everybody at that point, didn't he? I mean, we got to be talking about 2014 by now. Didn't he have heat with pretty much everybody?
Yeah, and that was the thing. He was the Huntington Beach bad boy, and he turned babyface, called himself the people's champ. And but if you lifted up the rug and swept underneath, you'd see that, oh, my God, this guy has screwed everybody over, all his friends, his training partners, his manager, you know, Dana White, you name it, everyone.
Is that pretty much his legacy in the business?
I mean, yeah, deep down, if, like, you're doing the undercover work and looking under it, yeah. But, yeah, he could, like, phony baloney, say, I'm the people's champ. And, like, for our fight, oh, my God. Like, remember that? Like, I came out to the rapper Stitches rapping Brick in Your Face, which is like the biggest heel song of all time. And he has tattoos of Stitches down his cheeks, AK-47s on his neck. Like, it's the epitome of a heel song. And Tito comes out to a bunch of little kids singing I Pledge Allegiance to the Flag. So, just,
talk about pro wrestling. And, you know, that wasn't even my idea. I was actually joking that to Coker when I told him I wanted to come out with that. And he's like, yeah, fine, no problem. I couldn't believe he said that. And then when I saw what he had in mind, the whole Pledge Allegiance thing with Tito, the old babyface angle, my God, it was brilliant.
Now, that was Bellator by now, in the 130s, 131, 132?
Yeah, that was, let's see, the big Bellator card after Coker took charge at the end of 2014.
And at that point, were you, I mean, how does it happen that you go from UFC to Bellator? Are you just done there? Are you asked to leave? I mean, how does that even happen? You're Stephen Bonner.
Yeah, I didn't want to go out, you know, like pretty much I was actually retired before I took that Anderson fight. I was working for the company of the UFC and getting, you know, paycheck and health insurance and all that. And anyways, after that fight, you know, I ended up losing my job. So when I went to Bellator and fought, I knew, like, deep down, it was just going to be one fight. It was just, like, before that fight with Anderson, I had been campaigning for a big fight, like, with maybe me and Forrest or me and Rampage or something like that. And it just wasn't going to get my way. And that was finally the chance to, oh, my God, if there's one guy in this sport, like, you know, because after Anderson, it was like, that's it. I'm retired. I hung it up. And when I'm like, my God, if I got to hang it up now, like, what would I wish I would have done? And like, that was the fight. That was a Tito fight. And it never happened. I was, like, hanging it up and retiring and going to be good with that. And, like, you know what? Like, I got one more in me. I got one more. Let me fight Tito. And, like, half of it was because, yes, I won that fight. I didn't like him. But the other half, because I got to be creative and kind of market it the way I wanted to. And I got to turn heel. And, yeah, people, like, downplay that. Like, it's really not a big deal. But you got to see where I was with in the UFC, I was like the baby face kind of crammed on people's throats. So this opportunity to turn heel and fight Tito was, oh, my God, I couldn't turn it down. It was just, it tasted so sweet.
And if I'm not mistaken, you lost a split decision that night. Is that correct?
Yes.
Did that hurt?
Of course, yeah. Of course. But at the same time, I did my best, you know? I did my best. And I knew it, like, kind of got rushed into it. I'd been on the shelf, and I knew I probably needed a little bit longer, but I thought I could do it, and I did my best. And, you know, close fight. I got tired in the third. He scored a takedown. I had to fight up off bottom a couple times, and I got a little arm weary, and I faded near the end, lost a split decision. But at the same time, just the enjoyment of just promoting that fight and like seeing the numbers it did and setting the record for the most watched fight of 2014, considering his fight before that with Shlemenko did like 335,000. And now we're hitting almost 3 million, like did over 10 times the numbers. That was because of me. And just knowing that, like knowing that what I did, what I set out to do kind of worked, even though, yeah, I lost a close one, didn't get the nod. Like my heart too, with all my fights has been the same way. It's not so much about winning or losing. It's about putting on a show. Like I always say in my interview, I'm more at heart of a pro wrestler. Like, my mindset, like everywhere, has never been just about the whole way I got to win at all costs. No, it's about like putting on a show. It's about winning people over. It's about doing what I did with Forrest and you know, just getting people to fall in love with the sport. And that's where my heart was. And like I set out to do a goal to get people to tune in, to crush the Shlemenko numbers, and I did it. And you know what? It sucked. I lost a close one, but at the same time, like I'd rather go out like that than going out losing to Anderson on short notice.
So before we cover the Hall of Fame, and then we'll get you out of here. Your 24 matches, it says 15 wins and 9 losses. We all know that not easily, but with a few dips and dabs in there, it could have been 20-4, 21-3. Does your record matter to you?
Honestly, no. Like, I don't get credit. Like, beating tough guys like Bobby Southwark, Mike Swick, like, I don't get credit for that. And I don't know if Terry Martin's on that, but I had a lot of matches in 2000 that, like, at Finke's Bar in Highland, Indiana, that aren't counted on my record for some reason or another. Aren't counted as professional fights, even though, like, they're no different than some of my other fights. And some of them do. Like, I get credit for, like, triangling a guy named Sean Sally in, I think, 2002, who, yeah, I mean, was way easier than, like, Southworth or Swick or a lot of my other pro fights. So, to me, no, that record doesn't mean really much. And, it really doesn't. Like for some reason or another, like, some sites or pages give credit for some wins and others don't. And, you know, back in that day in the early 2000s, a lot of stuff wasn't recorded, you know? And, you know, everyone, like, they'll ask me my record. And I honestly don't know. It depends who you're asking. It depends who you count, you know? If you're asking me, like, yeah, it's different.
So what happens? Does one day you're sitting on your couch or you're in a business meeting or you're working out in the gym and you get a phone call from Dana, say you're going into the Hall of Fame? How did that happen? Where were you? What were you doing? And tell us about that moment and how you felt.
I remember doing, like, an interview and someone telling me you're going in the Hall of Fame, and I had no idea. That's how I found out about it.
That simple, huh?
Yep. Yeah, it was part of an interview. How do you feel about going in the Hall of Fame? What, are you kidding me? Oh, yeah. Someone posted on UFC.com today that you're going to be inducted, and I had no idea. Surprise.
And was it an awesome for a surprise? And did you go in with Forrest?
Oh, yeah, of course I went in with Forrest. The funny thing was, Forrest, he's pretty witty. Me and him have been kind of having the battle of wits since Ultimate Fighter Season 1, so I found out, oh, my God, I'm going to the Hall of Fame with Forrest. Like, wow, I got to prepare a good speech because he is going to crush it. I don't want him to fucking outstage me. So I got to do something good. So they announce us to the Hall of Fame. I get up and, like, I crush it. I give, like, a great speech for 10 minutes or so. And I'm like, okay, we throw to Forrest. And I'm thinking, he's going to upstage me and say something even better. And he really just says, all right, everyone, thanks for coming out. And, like, he doesn't say anything. And it kind of, like, yeah, to me, I was like, what? Oh, my, like, yeah, it threw a monkey wrench in my plan. And that's just like him. He goes and screws up my fucking plans once again.
Are you still friends today? Do you guys, like, how do you see it in the future? Will you guys... Because, I mean, there's going to be anniversaries. There's going to be all kinds of stuff in the future. The greatest fight of all time, the fight that put UFC on the map. I mean, are you guys, do you see it someday like you guys will go on tour and do talk about it or be on all these shows?
After that fight for like 3 years, the UFC, we did everything together. We were like, yeah. He joke about it. He called me like herpes. Can't get rid of this guy because we, yeah. Like, we would do all types of PR and TV shows and this and that together. So that's his old long-lasting joke. And but actually, just the other week, we did a signing here at Galleria Mall down in Henderson, Nevada here. And it was just like old times. Like, you know, we get together and we get along really well. And he's actually a little jealous of me now. I'm in this counterterrorism school called CRI here in Vegas that we get to do all kinds of fun stuff from, like, shooting guns and, like, all these, like tests. That if you're going to get hired to do security and bodyguard work, you got to pass these shooting tests with a pistol and a rifle and rappelling and jumping out of airplanes and scuba diving and
this and that. And like, me and the school, CRI is the name of the school, are pretty tight. And now he is jealous and wants to be a part of it. So I'm thinking of, you know, talking to the owner and maybe saying this dude's all right. Should we let him in, give him a little trial run?
ever the prankster you are, my friend. So listen, let's get to the most important question of the night. When was the last time you were at a Who concert?
Oh my God, a Who? Oh my God, my dad took me, what was it, like 82 maybe? I think I was like, yeah, before I graduated kindergarten. Yep, I was in preschool still. My dad took
me. And you haven't been to a Who concert? Yeah,
it's been that long,
since?
Man. I've been to Page.
Oh my God, dude.
Yeah, Further Fest than like, but yeah, I haven't been to a Who concert since 82.
Weren't they like your entrance music for a while?
Yeah, if I was raised on them, man. Like, yeah, my dad loves Peter Townsend. Are you kidding me? Like, he's like Jesus, my dad. And I love Townsend too, but yeah, I just haven't seen him live in that long.
That's funny. Since 82. Jesus, man.
Yeah, yeah, my dad had a Bob Dylan concert. I think it was like 83. Yep.
Who do you listen to now?
I'm setting my ways, man. Like classic rock and 90s stuff, and then here and there a hip hop song that I like. But yeah, mainly like classic rock, 80s and 90s.
Listen, you're preaching to the choir here. I just got out of my car. I just went for a long ride right before getting on the radio with you, and that's why I asked you to start 15 minutes later because I was in some traffic. And I had Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young on. Then I put on Linda Ronstadt, and then I put on James Taylor. I mean, Jesus, Mary and Joseph. Like, I don't even know what. Like, I mean, I love Eminem. I could listen to Eminem all day, but that old stuff, it just still, you know, brings me back to my growing up, and I love that stuff.
Yeah, it's got soul to it, you know. That's what I said. Yeah. Stuff. It's entertaining, but it doesn't have the soul. Doesn't make you go deep.
What's the future for you, bro? What's going? You're with the CRI. Is that what it is? CRI in Vegas? What does the future hold?
Honestly, I want to learn the art of pro wrestling, man. I want to just hit the indie circuit, and just like I've learned the martial arts growing up as a kid, that's where I'm at. Like, I want to feel young again. I'm in my 40s. And that's making me feel like it. And like, good indie shows, man, just make me feel so alive and wholesome and young. And I love it. I really, really enjoy it. And I knew it too. As a little kid, that's what I wanted to be with. That's what I wanted to do with my life. And, I got sidetracked in the MMA. But man, like, now I'm getting a chance to see these good indie shows and their fans and, like, just eat it up and enjoy it. And, like, that's it, man. Like, I'll do a little stuff on the side. I'll, you're saying boring stuff, the counterterrorism school, maybe taking contracts or, you know, you know, working at security detail, this and that. But, like, me getting to learn the art of pro wrestling from the best of the best, man, you can't beat that.
Does Vince know this, or does Stephanie or Hunter or Jeff Jarrett or any of these people know about your passion for wrestling?
Yeah, I mean, I work with Jeff on Impact, this and that, but like, it's just something, you know, I got to do. Honestly, like, one of the guys that I've got a lot of inspiration from, Matt Riddle, man, like, he is at the top of the indie wrestling game. And like, honestly, the world of like top quality indie wrestling shows, man, that is something else. Like, just as a fan, to be in the audience and have like 2,000 people like chanting PC dub and just be all into the whole show. I actually saw, you know, Mick Foley out in LA doing his show, and he described it so beautifully. He said, like, because he was talking about doing WrestleManias with like, what, like 50,000 people, and like, what's the difference and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, it's of any less importance performing to like 500 people or 1,000 people or however many people compared to like the main eventing WrestleManias. And he said something, it was really funny. It was something about, I think, Terry Funk. After, like, Funk came back from his first WrestleMania that Mick was at. And Mick was all nervous. And how is it, Terry? Like, oh, my God. He's like, you know what? My eyes are bad. I can't see shit after the first three rows.
You get all that energy in one place, whether it's, like, you know, three rows and 1,000 people or, like, 30 rows and 100,000 people. Man, it doesn't mean anything, you know? And if, yeah. if your motives are good, if you're doing it for you, like, that's all that matters, you know? I mean, I'm not saying if people are doing the pro wrestling to get more famous or to get on, like, WWE, like, there's anything wrong with that. There isn't, you know? But for me personally, my motives for doing it is just to entertain an audience like that is captivated and who's interested in the story I have to tell. And yeah, I could get that in indie wrestling shows, you know, and like people like find that hard to believe. Like, well, dude, isn't your goal the WWE and this all? Like, honestly, no. Like the same magic I get like at PCW, like. When the crowd's like bumping and like doing their chant, like, man, it's no different. The fight with Forrest, that was at the Cox Pavilion in Las Vegas here. And I think it seats like 5,000 people. It wasn't even full. There's probably like 3,000 people there. And, you know, on TV, like 12 million end up tuning in. Do you think that made any difference to me? It's the same, you know?
Good for you, man. You got a great attitude. You really do. And I love the way you talked about Tito, you talked about heel turns and baby face turns. You really are a wrestling fan. So my hope for you is to live the dream. You've already lived a pretty dreamy life, my friend. You know, you made a difference. You made a difference in the sport. You made a difference to people. You turned a struggling company around and here you are all these years later, and you're so young. You're 40 years old, bro. You're a baby. You get your whole life ahead of you. That's the cool part.
Yes.
You know? Great. You have such youth.
Yeah. And MMA turns you feel old, but then, like, you know what? You turn the page, and you start learning again, and you feel young again and, like, invigorated by learning. Oh, that's the feeling, you know? I'm telling you, like, in MMA, I felt like that for a good solid 10 years. And then, it got to the point where it was, and I see that. Like, even, you know, I'm training with D'Lo Brown here, and he's not too much older than me. But, like, you can tell he's been doing it for so long. He's not, like, going through what I am at my age, you know? Like, he's seen it all, done it all. He's been there. And me, it's all new to me, and it's fun, and it's invigorating, and it's new, and I'm learning, and like that's what I'm really going after. That, if I could say one thing in this whole interview that I'm seeking out, it is to learn the art of pro wrestling.
That's it's beautiful. Beautiful stuff, bro. Beautiful stuff. Listen, wish you the best. Once again, Gurkha Triad has and Pat Bush and the Cigar Emporium have sponsored our show today. My producer, Larry, WWE historian on Instagram, didn't even know that. I'm popping him that at the last minute. I didn't get any money for it, Larry, so don't worry about it. But Gurkha has sponsored our show today. I thank Dave Bautista for inviting us to his wedding so that I could have met you, Stefan. And here about two years later. So shout out to Dave Bautista and
the summer of... Happy anniversary, Dave, come October.
That's right. Happy anniversary. He's a good guy, isn't he?
Hell of a guy.
Hell of a guy. I love it. Thank you, sir. Thank you for coming on the show. You didn't have to do it. We really appreciate you. We want a crossover audience. I don't want to be a wrestling show. I want to talk to you. I want to talk to Chael Sonnen. I want to talk to Kung Lee. I want to talk to, you know, to Holly Holmes or whoever. I want to Cyborg. I want to talk to everybody because you're such interesting people, and I learn from you all the time. So keep up the great work. Great interview. Thank you so much, and I hope to see you in the future, my friend.
Thank you, Jimmy. And if I could carry out one message, Genki Sudo, remember him? He'd carry the flag of all the countries up. We are all one. And like I feel like this, like no matter what world I kind of trip into is, man, we're all the same. We're all one.
We are all one. Love you, buddy. God bless you. Take care of yourself.
All right, Jimmy. Thanks, brother.
Yeah! forget they're hiding behind an eminent partner, an eminent partner to put on. It's just an eminent partner, an eminent partner to put on. It's an eminent fact to put on, to put on, to put on.